This episode was recorded before the COVID-19 pandemic, and the future dates of the Invictus Games have now changed. For more information, please visit InvictusGamesFoundation.org. My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. Our next guest has been responsible for orchestrating some of the biggest events this nation has ever seen. From the Queen's Golden Jubilee, to the Lord Mayor's Parade, to the work he does today. We speak about Burma veterans from the Second World War, and how today's wounded, injured and sick community are positively impacting society. An Invictus Games Foundation special, Dominic Reed. This is Declassified.
Whereabouts was you born?
I was born in London, in Hammersmith.
What did your mum and dad do?
Mum and dad were both architects and designers. So they were the wartime generation. Dad had his architectural training interrupted and gone away to the war and come back. And they were very much the people who were involved in the Festival of Britain in 1951. So they were sort of the young, cool mid-century designers.
What, like the 60s, 70s?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, all of that. And that's sort of what I grew up in. That's the world I grew up in. And Dad had a very wide-ranging... Well, Mum and Dad had a very wide-ranging practice. They did everything. You know, they designed furniture and lighting fittings for their buildings. They designed exhibition space. They did all the graphics. You know, it was the idea that you did everything. Why wouldn't you? It's fascinating. It's
so brilliant. From the building all the way through to the interior?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And lots of really interesting furniture, which actually we've now put back into production. So part of what I do in my life is try and work with their archive and reissue the furniture. We had an exhibition actually in London last October, which was great, really well attended.
Did you live in Hammersmith?
No, we lived in Highgate to begin with, and as I said, I mean, they had the practice at home. I sort of grew up in this working architectural environment. As I said, there was exhibition design and so forth involved in that, and out of that came a commission for my father to get involved with the Lord Mayor Show, which became a very sort of central part of the work that we then did carrying on. My father ran the Lord Mayor Show for 20 years, and when he died very unexpectedly of a heart attack at the age of 66, I was asked to take that over.
We're way off there yet, Dominic, but I want to keep us just at home for a second. As a real youngster, because I'm just picturing now like kind of a bohemian lifestyle. Was it like that, or was it quite kind of formal, especially with your dad's military career?
I don't think it was bohemian. I think it was eclectic. And you know, I think there was lots of really interesting elements to it that probably other middle-class families in London might not have had. But as you said, it was that my father had been in the war, had been in the military. He'd served as a Green Howard. He was discharged, you know, after the end of the war, having served in Palestine at the end of the war as a captain. And it was a very significant thing. I think it's something that he drew a lot from. I think he enjoyed it very much. And I think in another world, he could have, in another life, he might have carried on and been a professional soldier. Yeah. And it was very much, that element was part of who he was. And of course, you've got to remember that both grandfathers had served in the First World War as well. So whilst they weren't professional soldiers, you know, I don't come from a family of professional soldiers. I come from a family where every male generation has been asked to stand up and serve the colour.
The 13, you went to boarding school.
Yeah.
How did you adapt all right to that?
I did. I think I was, you know, I was homesick a little bit to begin with, perhaps. But actually, I loved it. I loved the freedom that it gave you. I loved all of the different things that you could do. You know, the sport, the comings and the goings, and the you know, music and drama and everything. I mean, it was just brilliant. And it was one. It was an occasion. You know, I think we were really lucky. There were some really inspiring teachers. We hear a lot nowadays, don't we, about teachers who have inspired. But there's a whole gang of really talented people. So I think I was very lucky. And also I was in a, you know, and I was having so much fun doing all of that stuff that I totally blew my A-levels. But I was at a school where they said, well, you know, have a go at Oxbridge, you know, why don't you try and get to Cambridge? So I did. I did seventh term Oxbridge and pulled it off.
And at school, kind of in your teenage years, was it sport? Was it kind of art? What was
it? To begin with, it was music. I had a music scholarship. To go to school, I went as a music scholar. I was a cellist, and I sang in the choirs, and I was a reasonably good cellist in those days. And then I discovered rowing, And I became, that really took over my life. So towards the end of my school career and throughout my university career, rowing was my passion. And I absolutely loved that.
Mm. And at school, how does it work? Because obviously I never went to a boarding school. Do you go Monday to Friday? Are you there for terms?
I was there for terms. It was a convention. You go away in September, you come back for a week or so in the middle of term, then you come back at Christmas, and then you go away again for another term.
Yeah. Where did you go?
I went to Oundle, which is in Northamptonshire.
Mm. Would you change it? Did you, like, as in, sounds very much like not, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but would you, if you could go back, would you rather spend time in London with your parents, or would you stay with
I think... It's a really interesting question. I think it's a question that you turn over in your mind perhaps as you get older. I think it was great in lots and lots of ways. I think it gave me a fantastic education. There are different schools. They've all got a kind of slightly different slant on how you might turn out. And it's interesting to think about how I might have been if I'd gone to a different school. But no, I'm happy with what it gave me. And I think that education, that sort of eclecticism, you know, linked perhaps with what I had at home, has led me in the direction that I've gone.
Mm. Were you close to your mum and dad?
Yeah, I was. Very close. And I ended up working with my father and mother after I graduated in their architectural practice as an architect. Yeah, very close. Mother's still alive. She's 96. Yeah. Absolutely redoubtable, fantastic woman. and you know, still taking herself into Truro on the bus because that's what you do. No, she's very close to both of them. And father died very, very young. He died at 66 of a heart attack, very unexpectedly. And that was a difficult time. And I was asked to succeed him in his role as pageant master of the Lord Mayor Show. And I think that was an important responsibility for me too. I'm sure psychologically that was a very important moment.
Had you seen him then growing up? Was that a major part of his life?
He got involved in that in 1972, which was just before I went away to school. And actually, that had affected, I think, decisions around where I was going to go to school. He'd gone to see a float being built by this school in Northamptonshire and was so impressed with it, he thought, right, that's a good place for my lad. So actually, the Lord Mayor Show has had a colossal impact. It's affected where I went to school. It's been the bulk of my professional career. It's been the backbone on which the other event work that I've done has been built. So yeah, I think...
What is it?
The Lord Mayor Show is a procession that takes place in November. It's over 800 years old. It takes place every year. And it delivers the Lord Mayor to swear an oath of allegiance to the sovereign, which was something that was instituted by the Charter of 1215. So it's been going since 1215. It was the first... it's the longest-running major public event to be broadcast on television. Mm. So it's been... it was first broadcast in 1937. So it's the longest-running television programme on the planet. And obviously, out of that, I've got a long relationship with live broadcast, and that plays into the whole world of events. And
so why does the Lord Mayor have to be kind of sworn in?
There was a deal struck between King John and the citizens of London that in return for their support, they would be allowed to elect their own representative, their own mayor. Yeah. But in order for him to, you know, for the king to have sight of who this was and make sure that he wasn't going to be a threat, he had to swear an oath of allegiance to the sovereign. And that's what the Lord Mayor Show, that's where it stems from.
Mm. Before you went to university, you had a stint in the army, but I've never heard of this kind of way of joining before.
I did a short service limited commission. And the short service limited commission, which still runs today, is a very, very short commission. And it's designed to fill the gap between school and university. And originally that gap was created because in the old days, you could do an exam called Seventh Term Oxbridge. If you wanted to get Oxford or Cambridge, you could do an exam after your A-levels, and that left you with a gap between then and going up to university in September. And the Army very brilliantly thought, right, we'll harvest all these people and we'll get them on board and we'll turn them into pro-military mindset people who will go off into industry and into commerce and do what they did. And I did that. So I went to Sandhurst in... At the beginning of 81, I did the very short course. I can't remember how long it was now, three or four weeks. And then, boom, you're out to BAOR in a field regiment, everybody knowing that you know absolutely nothing and you're cuffing it and having a good time.
And what are you doing in a regiment?
I was a gunline section commander in a field artillery regiment in Germany.
Yeah.
And it was an amazing experience. You know, it was a very formative part of who I am. And then because I was going to university to read architecture, and architecture is a long and involved course. You know, you've got postgraduate study after your degree. One thing and another, I chose that I chose to not go back as a regular soldier.
Mm.
But I've been involved in the reserves as well, though.
Mm. And where did you go to uni?
I went to Cambridge initially. So I studied architecture at Cambridge, and then I went to UCL to do my postgraduate, and then qualified. But yeah. It takes a hell of a long training to qualify to be an architect.
Did you work then, straight?
I did. I worked as an architect, yeah.
Did you enjoy it?
I did. I loved it. I worked on the Queen's Stand at Epsom Racecourse, which is a great building that won the FT Award for architecture in whenever it was, 1989. I did, and I could easily have stayed in that world. And I think I was sort of an unexpected or an unintended consequence was when my father died and I was asked to take over the show, which was very much part of his life and my life, as I've said. I sort of slightly moved sideways into events and away from architecture. And that wasn't really an intentional thing. It was me, I think, answering the call of duty as I saw it at the time and moving on. So that's what I did.
When did you find out your dad died?
He died in April, and he was away. He was down in Cornwall on a holiday, and I just literally got a phone call saying, I'm afraid he's gone.
Mm. Did it hit your heart?
Yes, I think it did. But I think in a curious way, the call, which was pretty quick on the heels of that, to say, well, would you carry on and do his job, continue this important work? I think that was a very important and positive thing.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about post-traumatic growth in your earlier podcast. I mean, you know, boom, suddenly you've got a job to do, and it's a job in his memory. It's carrying on his work, you know, and I think that's psychologically quite helpful.
Mm. And just to go back to, and I'm not going to dwell on it too much, but, it, you know, it's funny because my dad died in exactly the same way. I just received a phone call basically saying exactly what you just said.
Mm.
I remember where I was, exactly,
yeah,
all that kind of stuff, and it really hit me hard because we were close. But I didn't get that opportunity to carry on his work because he wasn't in that kind of field.
No.
Did you feel that you was worthy of kind of replacing him?
I think you feel... I think I did, and I think that was because he had always led me to believe that, you know, because we were close too. And I think it was, you know, it's also a challenge. It's, you know, I've got to live up to the memory, you know, and that... But as I said, I mean, that has clearly had an impact and an effect on me going forward, but I think it's overall been a positive one.
Mm. And then what does the... the job entail then?
The job for the Lord Mayor's show is creating and staging this extraordinary procession. And it's a procession that's 3 miles long with 7,000 people in it. And, you know, more military in the Lord Mayor's show than there aren't Trooping the Colour. You know, right. It's a big old gig and it's live on television. So you've got to make it run to meticulous time. So you need to know exactly what you've got on the ground. You need to know the length of every vehicle. You need to know the size of every marching detachment. You need to know the speed you're going to move it. And there's a colossal amount of detail that goes into creating a procession that's 3 miles long that you can't park up in one line. You have to park all over the place in bits and pieces and then put together and push onto this conveyor belt because your route is just under 2 miles, just over a mile and a half on the way out. And you've got a great team of military officers, reservists, who are helping you put this thing together, run it past the cameras and make it look as if it's all unforced and beautiful and celebratory, but actually a hell of a lot of work going into the back of that.
Mm. How did you actually learn to do it?
Well, I'd been involved, I mean, I sort of watched him do it, and
I worked
with him in holidays and done bits and pieces, and I'd been going to see it, you know, as a kid since I was sort of 11 and watching it. So I kind of had a really good understanding. And actually, I had a few years, two really pleasant years working with him, you know, as an architect, working on the show and really getting into the nitty-gritty. So I did know quite a lot. I didn't know everything at all, but I knew a few things. And you know, there are one or two things that I don't know, you get taught one. I remember the one thing that he taught me that I don't think, unintentional thing, I was... there were some carriages being infiltrated and I was just about to step forward and put it all right. And I remember this arm coming out and just stopping me. And I looked at him and he said, don't try and fix it. You'll just make it worse. You know, sometimes you just need to let it go. And that, as an event professional, that's the thing you need to know.
Is it?
Oh, absolutely.
Where did you go from then? So did you have... is that then when you got a love of creating events?
Yeah. And I do enjoy that creativity. I do enjoy the way that it's interpretive. I mean, for something like that, which looks for all the world as if it comes out of the same box as Trooping the Colour, it doesn't, because there's a way in which you can interpret and you can develop and design the ceremonial. It's a language. It's all about making something explicit to people. If you look back to 1215, this is about explaining to the people and to the sovereign who this person is. It's a tapestry that tells the story of who the man is and what his life is. It's all about making sure that the right sort of reverences, the right compliments are paid to the right people in the right way. So that's, you know, that takes you to drill, it takes you to guards of honour, it takes you to representative military units and bands, all sorts of things like that. And you can begin to play with that. And the best and most creative thing I ever did on that side was when, a few years later, in 2002, when we were doing the Queen's Golden Jubilee, we sort of completely broke protocol. If you're a military band and you're on parade and the sovereign passes, you play the national anthem. That's your way of saluting. That means that if the sovereign is, if the Queen's in riding in state from Buckingham Palace to St Paul's Cathedral, which she did in 2002, she listens to the national anthem 14 times because every band plays the national anthem. We thought, we can do better than this. And we composed a special suite of fanfares that were based on British folk tunes. So when she got to Temple Bar, there was a special fanfare. And then there was this rolling sort of sea of music that unfolded as she, in the Gold State coach, proceeded down to St Paul's. And then a special setting of the national anthem at the end. And, you know, I mean, that's a wonderful project to be involved with.
Mm.
And also amazing that we were able to get away with it. Mm. But it worked really well.
Yeah, you don't ask permission, you ask for forgiveness.
Exactly.
That's the thing, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
So what was your first kind of paid employment away from the Lord Mayor's Show? Did you get involved with...
The first other big gig I got on the back of the Lord Mayor's Show was the VJ Day Parade in 1995. So that was the 50th anniversary of the end of the war. And it was specifically to celebrate VJ Day.
What's VJ?
Victory in Japan. So this was, you know, there were two victory points at the end of the Second World War: victory in Europe, VE Day, and victory in Japan, which came later. So VE Day in I think May, isn't it? And in August you've got VJ Day. So that was when the war finally finished and the Japanese capitulated. And that, the interesting thing about that was that all of those people who'd fought out there and all of the people who'd been interned by the Japanese and had a really dreadful time, by the time they got back to the UK, by the time they'd been brought home, the victory parades were all over. The VJ Day, the main victory parade in the Mall had been and gone. So this is a whole generation of people who had suffered extraordinary hardship and privation and often torture and brutality, who had never actually had any formal recognition. They'd come home, and as you know, as we all know, that generation, the Japanese prisoners of war, the people who'd fought in the jungle, didn't really talk about it.
Mm.
So that actually became the most, I think, the single most moving experience that I've had.
Had they been forgotten then?
They had been forgotten. They were called, the 14th Army was called the Forgotten Army. I mean, they had been forgotten. And that parade in 1995 was the first time that they were formally recognised. So there was a service, there was a drumhead service outside Buckingham Palace around the Queen Victoria Memorial, at which these guys were there and they were present. And there was this, you know, there were thousands of veterans there who had served and not been recognised. And there were men who died during that service. And died very, very shortly afterwards. It was a point of extraordinary release for people who were by that point quite elderly and had felt, I think, very embittered and very abandoned for a long time.
What do you mean died during the service? You mean actually died?
I mean actually died. I mean, I had two radio nets that day. I had a net which was there was a military net and a police net, and within seconds of the service starting, there was a man down call, and the first person was stretchered away. It was an extraordinary thing. I've had a guards band fallen out, bearskin caps off, taking water to these guys because it was a very, very hot August day.
Mm.
And one of the things that I had to do, which was one of my duties, we had a parade which unfolded out of this service, which had lots of military elements and lots of civilian elements that had supported the war effort and so forth. But we had all the living members of the VC and GC Holders Association, and the primus inter pares of the VCs was a guy called Lachman Gurung, and Lachman Gurung was a Gurkha who had won his VC for fighting off two Japanese company attacks on two successive nights on his own with a Bren gun. So he, just extraordinary what this guy had done. They brought him from Nepal to London for this thing, and he was so small that when he arrived, we took him to the boys' department in Marks and Sparks on Oxford Street to buy him a suit. And I went down to collect him after this service to lead him to the car that he was going to be in the procession in. And there were ranks of guys in their blazers and berets and their medals, and there were blank files where people had dropped dead. And the people either side of them had remained at attention throughout. Oh. And these guys broke into a slow hand clap for Lachman Gurung.
Really?
I tell you what, it was smoky.
Yeah, I've got goosebumps.
It was just extraordinary. And that was just the beginning of a day that was just full of stories like that. Just extraordinary.
So a huge release then?
It was a colossal, yeah. And a great friend of mine who worked with me on it, he went home and came back in the following day, and one of his neighbours had gone home having been at the parade and had quietly drifted away in the night because, they had that release. It was extraordinary.
Sounds very much like, we can look at this as an event, or you as an events organiser at this point, but actually there's something much more to this. This is like bringing people together and bringing communities together.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, why do you do an event? I mean, you do an event because it has a significant emotional impact on the people who are involved. Otherwise, you just watch everything on television. It's bringing people together so that creating a special moment where something happens, where there's recognition or there's an exchange of feelings or mutual respect. I mean, that's what it's about. There's an incredible power in events. There's an incredible power in every type of event, whether it's, people being together to watch a rugby match or a football match or that's powerful in itself. But things like this where you're marking specific moments and you've got people there who were part of that moment and you've got an ability for them to interact with others. It's just extraordinary. There was a guy in that parade. There was a friend of mine, a man called Jeremy Gotch, and he had been interned in Changi as a kid. So he and his family were expats, and they'd ended up in a prisoner of war camp. So he was in Changi jail, and he was walking down the mall with that group of people who'd had that similar experience. And he and there were people applauding him. He said to me, he said, "I don't get it. I don't understand. What did I do? I was just a kid. I was frightened. I was interned." And there were people thanking me.
Mm.
Now, that had a very, very profound effect on him. But it will have had an effect on the people who were watching him pass. We had the youngest recipient of the Civil Defence Medal, a boy who'd won the Civil Defence Medal at 16, right? For digging a woman out of a bombed-out basement during the Blitz. Mm. And he was marching in a parade in 1995, 50 years later, as a member of St John Ambulance, and he's halfway down the mall, and a woman, rushes out into the street and throws her arms around him, and it was the woman that he'd dug out.
Jeez.
I mean, how does that happen? And this, you've got to remember, all these stories I've just... That happened all on the same day.
Yeah.
It was an extraordinary kind of upwelling of emotion and healing and closure and finality. I mean, absolutely extraordinary. That's what the purpose of doing things, creating a structure and a framework. That's why you do it.
Yeah.
And ultimately, that's what we've done with Invictus. That's why it's powerful. It's powerful in slightly different ways because it's curative. It's not final.
But I mean, this sounds amazing. Like this, especially that what you just said. I mean, I've had goosebumps twice there when you're talking. and just the woman running out. Can you imagine what it must have been like for her just to be like a...
Absolutely. Well, I mean, the fact that you see a face that's 50 years older than the face that you saw when the rubble was cleared from your face, are you ever going to forget that face? Sure, of course you're not. So there's a human connection there that just totally transcends age and everything that's gone between, isn't it? You can see that moment. But what are the chances of that happening? You know, that's the thing that I've... It's those little things where...
It's a moment in time,
where those little moments, those little coincidences, those little happenstances, and that's what is so amazing. And that, you certainly see that at Invictus. You see that at every kind of event, but it's those little moments. That's what heals, that's what cures, that's what takes the whole story forward.
Did you get the same feeling then at the Falklands 25th anniversary?
Absolutely.
I mean, and what goes into creating that event? Do you have to? Sorry, go on, carry on. I think just.
Well, with the Falklands, was very different. I mean, the Falklands was 8,000 miles away from anywhere. It, you know, it's a barren place. It was, it was my generation's war. I mean, I finished my short service limited commission shortly before the Falklands. But the guys, you know, most of the forward observation officers were from, you know, from 4-9. They were people that one knew or had met. It was my generation that went away and fought that war. And I've got friends who fought in it. And it was a tough and gritty thing. Mm. And all I was doing was coordinating an event. So the government plan was that there was a service at San Carlos Cemetery, which is where our remaining unrepatriated bodies are buried, including H. Jones, VC. So in that cemetery, which is on a remote beach, miles off the end of the road in the middle of nowhere, and horse guards, where there was going to be a formal drumhead service, which there was, and how do you coordinate those two things so that you can broadcast it, basically. So if you... the technicality of my boring bit of that was that, you know, if you're gonna go from one verse of a hymn and then transfer across to the Falklands 8,000 miles away, you've got to think about 8,000 miles. You've got to think about the rotation of the Earth and what that does to the timing, because otherwise you end up out of sync. And when once you've gone one way, you can't come back again because it'll only work. So my responsibility was to make that all join up, and we did that, and we did that brilliantly. But it was a very, very moving occasion. And you know, and when somebody who was there, somebody who was a hero, grasps you warmly by the hand and says, bloody good job, well, you just don't feel worthy. I mean, you know, it's just emotional. It really is.
Mm.
With all of these things, you find out the stories behind it, and you also meet people who, for whom being there is a very, very, you know, it is a point of closure for them.
Mm.
And I think, you know, the Falklands was far removed from the Second World War. It was before Afghan and Iraq and all of that. But you have a very sadly a group of people, veterans who committed suicide as a result of in the aftermath of the Falklands War, which almost balances the number of battle casualties.
Mm. No, it was an amazing time, and then what proceeded after that, those years after, and especially with that suicide kind of number that has increased, and that can increase, and that has happened for various different reasons, but it's the coincidence is really, I mean, the numbers, you know, don't add up, I suppose. Bringing people together, especially like the Falklands guys, because they're still young, do you think that has a cascade effect? Do you think that they get together more often after about kind of these big events? Do you think it's a catalyst for kind of bringing communities back together for
I think it probably is. I mean, I think that human contact thing is important. But I also, and I think that might happen, and I don't have any kind of evidence to say, well, lots of people have now talking to each other who weren't. But I think there's one shouldn't underestimate the value of that chance encounter and that one-off, even if it's just catching somebody's eye or grasping their hand, that moment.
Yeah.
That actually can be as valuable as anything else. That can be as valuable as a rekindled friendship. That's the kind of the magic of what events, what live, it's that encounter, it's that way in which it just makes a difference.
Why did you go to the Royal Society?
I was headhunted for that, and that was an absolutely fascinating and wonderful job. I think, you know, you'll have picked up from what I've been saying that you know, I've been privileged in my career that I've done a lot of things which have fundamentally changed me. You know, something like that Vijaydeva Parade changed me. Working for the Royal Society changed me. It changed intellectually the way I look at the world around me. You know, I was working with scientists. I'm not a scientist. I mean, I can sort of vaguely kind of get most of the concepts, you know, but I, you know, here's me with a degree from Cambridge and a postgraduate from UCL having to explain to a bunch of people that I'm not the stupidest person in the world. If they can explain it to me, that's great, but actually there's lots of people who need to understand science who don't maybe have a degree. And working with that, being close to the best scientific brains and the best scientific thinking in a world which is all about excellence, excellence of science, excellence of thought. It was a fantastic, fantastic experience. We created a year of celebration, really, around science and what science was about. That I think to a large extent changed the kind of the conversation about science. I mean, I was always asked, "Who's your audience?" And my audience, in my mind, was the 60 million people who live in the UK. You know, we needed to do the same thing that had happened around modern art. You know, where you can jump into a taxi and talk about the Chapman brothers and the cabby also. Oh yeah, that Tracy Emin. You know, you needed to have that conversation around science, and we were in that at that time. You know, if you were saying, "Well, I don't know much about science," I was like, "Hey, you couldn't say I don't know much about Shakespeare," or you know, there was a mismatch, a real mismatch there. And we did a lot of work about communicating science to the public, and I think a lot of it went really really well. And if you look at what happened after that, you know, science in the comprehensive spending review that followed 2010, 2011, science got a level cash settlement, and I think some of the communications work we did around that had an impact.
What was your job title there?
I was the director of the 2010 anniversary. And we ran 1,500 events around the world throughout a year. I mean, ranging from a convocation with, you know, the Queen and pretty much everybody in the royal family in the Royal Festival Hall. We had exhibitions. We created a fantastic book that Bill Bryson edited for us. And when I say edited, I mean, you know, he was sitting at my desk correcting punctuation properly. I mean, it was extraordinary what we could do. The guy I worked with came to me with an idea about a performance of 2001, A Space Odyssey, which was brilliant. And we stripped out the soundtrack. We got Lady Kubrick to let us do this. Warner Brothers gave us a fresh print. And we had the London Philharmonic play the soundtrack live to a packed audience on the first night of the science festival that we ran in the summer. You know, that was the first of those. You go on the tube, look at the posters, you can go and see a film with a live soundtrack. There's lots of that, but we did that.
Mm.
And you know, so again, creative, but really rather wonderful stuff that we managed to do.
Mm. And you enjoyed your time there, because you were there for
I was there for three or four years. I absolutely loved it. I absolutely loved it because, you know, the quality of what we were doing was fantastic. You know, you're talking about remarkable people, remarkably bright people. You're talking about all the important issues. I mean, we polled the Fellowship of the Royal Society are probably the greatest scientific minds, certainly in the UK and in the world, you know. And we polled them all on what they thought the biggest and most important scientific developments of the next 50 years was going to be. And in science, you know, typically everybody's got a different view about everything. But there was a very clear guide that actually this was about the mind-brain barrier, that it was about consciousness and how the brain works and what's the difference between a brain and a mind, and how does that... That's where the interest lies. And that's fascinating, because you come back to what we are talking about in the veteran space. It's about mental health and wellness and, you know, all of that. So very interesting that there's a focus and a direction of travel there that everybody's sort of thinking about.
When was you first approached by the Invictus, or before it was even...
Well, I was contacted. It would have been in the autumn of 2013. So there'd been some preliminary work done. There'd been a feasibility study prepared and some of the Royal Foundation guys, Wisey and co, had been out to David Wiseman and had gone out with Prince Harry to see the Warrior Games in the US. And there was a plan to do something similar in the UK. And the I think in the US, you know, brilliant, a brilliant idea, but it was American. It was the different commands competing against one another. It wasn't really international. There were a few Brits who were invited out there. But it was Prince Harry who had this fantastic idea to internationalise it and to work on what they were doing in bringing friends and family together. And then they came back and Prince Harry famously announced that this was something that he was wanted to do in the UK, and he wanted to do it next September. So suddenly the phone goes. His private secretary at the time, Jamie Lowther Pinkerton, who had worked with at the Royal Society with his other principal, with Prince William, who had become a Royal Fellow at the Royal Society, and that's the connection, rang up and said, you know, what are you doing? Are you busy? Because we're going to need some people who can do this stuff to turn this idea into a reality. So I went to the first meeting, I think, in December of 2013, and the following September, boom, London 2014, we put it on. It was an amazing, that was a ride.
How does it work then? So you're going for an interview, a kind of job interview, you then get the job. Who are you employed by? And then how do you go about setting a team up to create that event, which was amazing?
So that, interesting question. I was interviewed. I wasn't in a position to do the project director job. We got a guy called Ed Janvrin to do that. He was absolutely brilliant. There was they'd established what they call a CIC, a community interest company. So it wasn't a charity, but it was a. The thing about a CIC is that there's an asset lock on it. So you have to then determine that if you make any profit with this company, that profit then goes to charity or is handled in that way. So there was this nascent organisation. There was nobody populating it. The Royal Foundation had gone out and they'd found Sir Keith Mills, who had been the deputy chair of London 2012, and he had got together a board. So there was the form of a board coming together at that point. I was asked to get involved. We got Ed on board, so he was the project director. We had a finance director, Robert Cresswell, and there were people at the foundation who'd been working on it very hard, coming together. So there was this sort of team just kind of came together, and it was made up of people with, there were freelancers, there were people with particular event experience. There was a contractor who had done the feasibility study, CSM, and that work had been led by a lady called Mish Dight, and that and we had the basics of a plan to work on. And then we had to put this thing together in absolutely no time at all. At that point, we didn't have a name for the event. We didn't have any money. We just had an idea that it was going to happen in September.
Mm. So what have you got to do then to get it to fruition? What have you actually...
Well, I mean, a huge amount of concurrent activity. I mean, you need a plan, you need venues, you need... I mean, at that point, we didn't have rules and categorisations. So, you know, Invictus has its own set of categorisations, which is different to what the International Paralympic Committee do. We had to have select the sports that we were going to use. We had to invite the countries that were going to participate. In at that stage, we had initially 13 nations participating in 2014. We now, this year in The Hague, we'll have 20 nations. So we had 13 nations, so we had to invite them. They had to understand what we were talking about. They had to get their heads around the concept. They had to then find a team, put a team together and work out how they were going to get them across. We had to find hotel rooms. We had to find, venues. We had to work out what we were going to do for an opening and closing ceremony.
Sponsors, were they involved for this? Did you need sponsors as well?
Absolutely, we needed sponsors. Yeah. And I was involved more on the operational side, but that was, you know, we were very, very lucky in Jaguar Land Rover, who came in as our presenting partner and have been with us ever since. But they, you know, they were being asked to fly a kite, really. What were we doing? You know, what was this all about? We came up with a short list of names, and Invictus was the name that won, and that was based on the poem, William Ernest Henley poem, you know, which famously ends, "I'm the master of my fate, I'm the captain of my soul." That, I think, was really, really important. And then there was a nice little happenstance. The people who were looking at the corporate identity, at the graphic design, came up with the Invictus Games words stacked on top of one another, which pulled out the I am. And I am then became very much a figure of what it was about. I am. That just came out of the name. That was that. And then if you look at, you can go and talk to competitors now, the number of competitors who actually have I am tattooed on themselves at somewhere, it's a very important part of the whole notion of what we were about. But no, there was a lot, an awful lot involved. And it all had to be done at extraordinary pace.
Mm-hmm. What was the purpose of Invictus?
The purpose of Invictus was to have a games for anybody who had been wounded, been injured or become diagnosed sick in service or as a result of service. So it was for veterans and for serving men and women. It was always for all of those three categories. So we've had people who were wounded, battle casualties, people who were injured, you know, either in a training accident or in a car accident or whatever it was, and people who've been diagnosed sick, whether it's cancer or MS or whatever. Mm. We've always had that cross-section. We've always had veterans and we've always had people serving from across the different nations. And then it was competing across nine sports and creating the best possible environment in which for that could happen, that allowed the public to see these people doing what they were doing and getting beyond injury and achieving extraordinary things that they didn't think they were going to be able to achieve.
Do you think there was a societal change or maybe a mindset change?
I think there was. I think there was. And I think, I mean, that's a, you know, we knew that we could put an event on. We knew that we were all professional enough to be able to deliver something that stood up and looked like the real thing. There are two things we didn't know. We didn't know whether the sport would be compelling to watch. We didn't know whether, because we didn't have personalities that were known personalities in those. So we didn't have sporting personalities. We didn't have the, you know, the JJs and the Hensons and the Ellie Marks and all these people who we now know as characters. We didn't know any of those people at that time. So we didn't know that it was going to be compelling sport to watch. And we didn't know how the public were going to take it on board. And when I say the public, I do mean the British public, because it was a UK event and it was broadcast predominantly by the BBC. And what happened was extraordinary, was that the sport was extraordinarily compelling. I mean, it really is emotional. It really does draw you in. And you found, you know, sometimes the person coming last was the person getting the loudest cheer. So that started to really deliver. And the public just really took to it. And it wasn't just the, if you like, you know, the Help for Heroes supporting usual suspects. It wasn't the people who were already in the camp, very pro-military, very support our boys. It was a much broader church than that. It was people who might even have protested against the Iraq war, but recognised the human story in all this, recognised what these men and women had done, the service that they had given, and also their own personal story in overcoming life-changing injury. That was extraordinary. And there was a piece of genius on behalf of the BBC. I mean, we've spoken about the things that I've done in the past, but that it was a combination of the BBC using their sports broadcasters, who are brilliant, and their events people, who do Trooping the Colour and the Lord Mayor Show, to create the narrative and the structure and the background, and bringing those two elements of BBC production together to deliver the Invictus Games to the people in a way that they really got it and went, wow. And that's what made the shift. Mm. And I think it did a lot of things, but I think it did begin to affect the way disability was viewed. And we certainly had emails from people who said, you know, I've been disabled since birth and I just never realised that was possible. And now I'm going to do things slightly differently. I'm going to, you know... So it became quite. I think there was quite a shift there.
Hmm. And what did you? What's your opinion of that initial kind of group of athletes? Because they really were athletes at that point as well. You know, they had disability and some injury, but
they were. Oh, absolutely. I mean, we always made a point of calling them competitors rather than athletes. And the reason that we do that and have always done that is because, absolutely, you're going to get elite level performance and you're going to get the most extraordinary things. You've got, you know, I think in Rio, 11 former Invictus competitors went to Rio for different nations. You know, phenomenal. But it's really important to keep that bottom end open, to allow people who just want to have a go to come and have a go. And it's keeping that balance and keeping that going. But, you know, I think there's a if you look at what we the hill we were trying to climb in terms of communicating the idea and the concept to people, did rely to some extent on visible injuries. At that time, there were, you know, we were still taking injuries in Afghanistan and Iraq to some extent, and these were people with relatively fresh injuries. So there were battle casualties, very visible prosthetics, you know, scarring. It was very gritty. That imagery was necessary to get the point across. Some of those people have now kind of got beyond, you know, they've competed, they've moved on, you know, JJ being a very good case in point. You know, he competed in the first games and he commentated on the second. And you know, so there is a sort of a transition. We are taking, we the UK, you know, and the US to some extent are taking fewer casualties in that way. But if you talk to the Ukrainian team, that's not true of them at all. You know, the Ukrainian team in the Hague will be composed entirely of people who have been very recently injured and have and do have amputations, multiple amputations. So it's not the same for every country.
Mm. Was it always the case that you were going to do a second one?
No, I don't think it was. I think to begin with, it was let's get this thing done, let's make it work. There was no question of recycling it in 2015. It just was never going to be possible because we'd sort of missed the start point of getting that process going. So the next idea was, well, let's try and go to 2016 and then maybe 17 and then maybe onto a two-year cycle after that, so 17, 19, 21. That became the idea. But to begin with, we were absolutely focused on just doing a one-off. It was designed to be a Games to celebrate and to showcase these people, give them most extraordinary experience and help them along their recovery pathway. Mm. Then it became clear that this was too good to just mothball. And so I was asked to establish the Invictus Games Foundation, which I did. So we set that up in 2015. We had a board, and we have a board, composed of people who had been on the original board for 2014, but it was a slightly smaller. I think there were 14 on the board for 14. It was a big old structure. But we set up the foundation. We then started to look at potential host cities, host nations, and we ended up going to Orlando in May of 2016, and that was the start of the journey. So Orlando, then to Toronto, then Sydney, and now to The Hague and beyond to Dusseldorf.
What have you found? Well, what have you seen in terms of competition, the people that are competitors, public perception, sponsorship, the commercial element of it between London and Sydney? We'll talk about Hague for a second, but just between those first four, was there any shift?
I think there have been shifts. I think it's been gradual. You know, we've been very lucky to have consistent support from a number of great organisations, you know, whether that be Jaguar Land Rover, ISPS Handa, Fisher House Foundation, who've been backing us all the way through. We've had other organisations support us and come on board. You know, Superdry have been involved more recently. We've had good support on that side. But that's always you've always got to work hard to go out and find the money. And we've worked hard to support the foundation because the foundation is separate from the games. We, if you like, are the international governing body, or an international federation, really, and we cause the games to happen, and we do that by licensing them to a host city, and typically, what will happen is that a special purpose vehicle, a special charity, will be established, as we established the KIC in 2014, to run that games. We license it to them, and they are then responsible, with our help, for finding their own sponsorship and doing...
Has that been an evolution, then? Going from that CIC down to now this, the Invictus Games Foundation, did that evolve over those games?
Yeah, I mean, there was a quick shift. I mean, at the end of 14, the KIC was wound up. The money that the KIC had managed to hold on to after the games, which wasn't very much, was enough to start the foundation. We established the foundation, which is a charity. It's a UK charity, but with an international scope and reach. And that money from the KIC, as the rules around KICs would have it, that was given to the new charity, and that was our base. That was our starting point. Mm. And since then, we fundraised for our own you know, to keep the lights on and to employ people to do the work. And we've given the games, we've licensed the games to different organisations in different countries, and they have paid a licence fee for that. That's helped to fund us. But the bulk of the money has gone to running the games. And one of the things that we've done, if you look at it, is that we're careful to engineer the cost down to make it an attractive proposition going forward. So, you know, London was run very tightly. Orlando, they did a fantastic job with it, on the Disney estate there. They did their own fundraising for that. Toronto became more expensive, but since then we've tried to engineer it down. So we engineered it down in terms of cost from Toronto to Sydney. We're engineering it down again to The Hague, so it becomes, you know, good value for money, a good proportionate spend to deliver something that has... Yeah, I sort of liken it to a beacon. It's a beacon that attracts attention. It attracts people from that Wounded Injured community to it, and it's very important, and it's keeping that bright light burning that fuels all the other things that happen around it and in its wake. And you've spoken to lots of people on your podcast, you know, whether it's the creation of the Kazivac Club, or, you know, Invictus Games Racing, or there's all sorts of things that have gone on that have been caused by that. By that happening.
A real catalyst into growth and development beyond the sport. I suppose, you know, we look at kind of the individuals. I kind of give you a massive question before that. So, but the individuals, are we seeing a change in those? Do people come back again and again? Are we seeing more from Iraq and Afghanistan? Are we seeing more from previous generations like Falklands, and whatever, are we seeing the new guys who have been injured in training or whatever now?
I think there's again, it you know, there's a UK answer to that, and there are different answers from 20 different nations. Really, the answer is we are seeing more invisible injuries. We always had a categorisation for invisible injuries, which the Paralympics don't. That's a very important part of what we do. It's always been an important part of what we do. We are seeing more of that. In the UK, you know, a UK team or an American team, you're probably seeing fewer battle casualty amputees and more people with training injuries. But as I said, that wouldn't be true if you look at you look at Ukraine. If you look at the Danish team, the Danes were the first people to put together a team entirely with psychological injuries and not with physical injuries. So yes, there is going to be a shift, and that shift is going, you know, it is going to move. So you've got more people presenting with invisible injuries now. I think, I mean, it's not a tidal wave, but there's a gentle push in that direction. But you still got people with amputations. You still got, you know, people having corrective surgery to stumps and all of the rest of it, revisions and things. So yeah, you've got that. The other thing is that if you want to bring in more nations, which clearly we do, you've got to reduce the team size, because we're keeping the pool of competitors at 500. And the reason we do that is because if we creep much above 500, it suddenly becomes a multi-week event. Then it suddenly becomes exponentially more expensive and unwieldy and difficult to do. So the decision has been made to keep it at that level. That means that we have to reduce team sizes. So the UK team is smaller now than it was in 2014. But we've got other teams coming in. Now, that has another impact on things, which is that it then becomes more difficult for a team to have enough points to be able to put on the court for a team sport. So one of the things that we found was that if there's a clash in the program and somebody has to make a decision between a sport where they've been training in their own discipline on their own to do their thing, or having a go at a relatively sort of lower level team sport team, like, for example, sitting volleyball, 9 times out of 10 they'll go for the team sport, because this is all about being part of the team again, right? So if you say, well, actually you can't do archery and sitting volleyball, which one do you want to do? We do find often as not that they'll go for the team sport. So there's that. And what you found in Sydney were an increasing number of what we called unconquered teams, where in order to get a game, in order to get a match, in order to get involved, you'd have competitors from different nations coming together to create a composite team. And that's an interesting trend to watch. I don't know what the outcome is. I don't know what the answer is. But if you take it, you know, logically, if you take that to its ultimate conclusion, do you end up with teams that are people from different nations competing together and working together?
Mm.
It's a very powerful concept.
Who looks after the teams? Because it very much sounds like you're the almost the admin side of things and like the makers of this and the kind of adjudicators as such. So who's looking after the men and women of Team UK or
so team each team will have its own team management. So there'll be a group of people in country who select and coach and treat and train and look after that team. So when a team comes to the Invictus Games, it comes with, you know, its medical support and its physios and its team managers and its coaches. And crucially, it comes with friends and family. So for every competitor, the Invictus Games will pay for two members of their friends and family to come and be with them. And that has been a really significant thing. Mm. And going back to what we were talking earlier about those moments where things happen, one of the non-obvious benefits of the Invictus Games has been friends and family from different nations meeting together, hanging out together, found that they derived extraordinary benefit from just that experience. Now, if you wrote that down on a bit of paper and said, well, we're going to do this project and we're going to have people sitting in a hotel lobby with people from another country who've had a similar experience, people are thinking you're bonkers. But it has an absolutely, you know, extraordinary effect. And friendships are formed and people realise that they're, you know, the experience is a shared experience. Very powerful stuff.
Mm. And I suppose seeing their loved one achieve as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that has been extraordinary. And the emails and the communications that we've had from people, from friends and family who have witnessed their loved ones do things that they never thought were possible are so moving. I mean, it's extraordinary. And you know, from the benefit of the experience that I'd had when we were just about to go live with 2014 and we were briefing the team, and fundamentally a young team, and then I was older than most of them, and I was asked, did I want to say a few words, because they'd just had their briefing, and was there anything I wanted to add? And it turned out I was on my way out to dinner, so I was wearing a dinner jacket, and they were looking at me like, you silly old, you know. And I said, well, you know, the obvious things from my event experience is that time will speed up. So time behaves differently when you're in a pressurized situation. I'm sure it's the same in combat, but it's certainly true with events that time speeds up as the closer you get to the event. So, you know, that's just going to happen. You'll sense it, but it's okay. Everything's going to work all right. Look after yourself. Make sure you're hydrated and, you know, you've got change of clothes and, you know, everything you need. And I said, the other thing is that highly likely that you'll get blindsided by something emotional during the course of the week. You know, it'll come at you, something will affect you, and it's okay to cry. You know, you can take time out and have a, but you probably will have to have a bit of a cry. And you can see them kind of going, this, what a silly old git, you know. And pretty much everybody came up to me at some point during the week and said, thanks for that. Thanks for permission, because this happened or that happened. Or I remember that my trigger was an email that Prince Harry's private secretary, Adeline Fox, sent to me, which was from a woman who was just thanking us for the fact that she'd seen her husband smile. Mm. And it wasn't something that she'd been able to cause to happen. I mean, that did for me on that occasion. But they, you know, it's those moments, and there are lots of them. You know, going back to what I was saying earlier on about the VJ Day thing, you know, but you look at what we've done at Invictus, some amazing stories. I mean, perhaps the story that just wraps it all up in an extraordinary way. When we were doing 2014, I was the Silver Commander. Two people had that role, me and Richard Smith, and we stagged that. So we were one on one off. And it became clear that a member of the American team who'd arrived in the UK had become ill and was deteriorating. And it was deteriorating to a point where we were beginning to look at how we would repatriate a body. Mm. And this person, Elizabeth Marks, ended up going to Papworth. She ended up having treatment at Papworth that saved her life that wasn't available to her in the US. I think both because technologically it was an advanced technique that, they'd pioneered over here, but also I don't think her health insurance in America would have covered it. So her life was saved by the NHS. She ended up going to a military hospital in Germany for a period of time before being sent back to America. She got back to America. She got better. She got back in the pool, started training again. She came back to Orlando, the Orlando Games, and won a gold medal in swimming. And famously, she when Prince Harry presented her with the gold medal, quietly after the ceremony, she handed it back to him and said, "Can you make sure that this gets to the nurses and doctors at Papworth who saved my life?" So, of course, he hands it to me. And we made sure that that happened. And then I was sitting watching a game of wheelchair basketball, and a tweet came through from Papworth of the nurses holding up pieces of paper that just said, "Thank you, Sergeant Marks." And it just so happened that she'd come and sat down next to me at that point, and I just showed her this tweet, and she just crumpled, folded. Now, she didn't only win a gold medal at Orlando, she won a gold medal at Rio. And she had an elective amputation after that. You know, this is, I mean, that's an amazing story. Not, you know, this is somebody that nearly died on the battlefield, nearly died of a pulmonary infection in London, who then went on to win gold not only at Invictus but at Rio, who's now, you know, a motivational speaker. And I mean, just extraordinary. Just extraordinary.
What's the future? Just before we get to that point, is this... Because my, I kind of was going to ask you, is Invictus, do we put it in a box and then bring it out when war is declared?
That was the question. I mean, that was certainly the question that we thought long and hard about before. Because I think, you know, I think there was a point where, when we were in Toronto, we were having that debate was live. And, you know, we had a couple of games. It's jolly good. It's a great product. Do we mothball it and put it in a box and then use it later? And the answer was no, we think we should carry on with it. Now, there's a growing demand. If you talk to any of the team management, you know, whether it's in the UK or the US, there are lots and lots of people wanting to go for selection, wanting to go to the Invictus Games. Colossal numbers of people. There are, you know, we've got cities beating a path to our door to host it in the future. So that's telling a story. Now, is the profile of the people involved changing? Of course it is, and it'll change in one direction. It'll probably change back again, you know. But at the moment, our plan is to keep going, to move to the two-year cycle and to do two things, to keep the games going. So we know that we're going to Dusseldorf in 2022. We're now doing a piece of work about what 2024 will look like going forward and where we might go and how we might deal with that. And we're working to encourage nations to share best practice and to talk to one another about how they deal with recovery. And there's a huge amount of work to be done there that we can catalyse. We're not going to do the work because we're not the experts. But, you know, given the conversation we had earlier on about my work at the Royal Society, I managed to get a fantastic partnership between the Invictus Games Foundation and the Royal Society, which is happening very shortly. That's amazing because we're talking about cutting edge science that has an impact around what we're doing now. You know, I know Neil Greenberg would say that we're all about applied research at Invictus, but the reality is that there is some research out there that needs to be done. There are questions that need to be asked. And in a world in which things are more siloed than they ever would be, perhaps sometimes we're in a position to ask some interesting questions. I think personally, there's a very interesting piece of work around blast and inflammation and mental health that I think is only, we're only beginning to scratch this. When I say we, that the people at the leading edge of that are only beginning to scratch the surface of. You know, there are things that really need to be thought about very carefully. This is an extraordinary cohort of people, and we're going slightly off. This isn't about everybody who's going to be wounded or going to have mental health problems from service. This is about that cohort of people who were the unexpected survivors of the Afghan war. That cohort have had a medical experience and will continue to do so for the rest of their lives that is unique and hopefully will be unique, you know, for generations to come. But it allows research and discovery to happen for an understanding of the human condition and the human body and the medical science around it to unfold in a way that benefits absolutely everybody, you and I and, mm. and everybody we know. And that, you know, so there are things, you know, there's the care and the love and the support that that generation needs, that those people who have served and have sacrificed need, but there's also what they can give back. Now, they talk, as you know, about giving back societally, and that's absolutely true. How do you bottle the Invictus spirit? How do you cause those values to be communicated to the civilian community? That's really important. But there's also, how does the research that's based on their experience, the work that, you know, I don't know, Alex Crick or someone is doing, how do we find out more? How do we use that in the best possible way so that when these guys come to the end of their lives and the Kazovac Club closes up in the way the Guinea Pig Club closed up, what has been that legacy? Have we made the most of that? Have we been as intelligent and as clever as we can to extract from tragedy the best possible series of answers?
Mm. You know, go right back now to Lord Mayor, your dad working on it, and then him passing the kind of baton to you, and looking through VJ Day, the Falklands, and now certainly Invictus. Just close on this. Did you think that he'd be proud of what you've achieved?
Something I can't really explain. I always felt, and it's probably the sort of, you know, the background of having grandfathers and fathers who'd served, I always felt a very, very strong moral compunction to honour and to respect people who'd served in that way. Am I proud of what I've achieved? Yes, I am. I mean, I think I've been very fortunate to work on pretty high-level projects. The Lord Mayor Show is, you know, the best Lord Mayor Show I've ever seen was last year's Lord Mayor Show. Well, that's a matter of great pride. VJ Day and the Falklands were extraordinary things where I saw healing happening around me. That was an amazing thing to do. The work around science was a privilege to be part of. And Invictus has been amazing because what it has done is it's taken those elements and it's moved it into real time. We're working with people who are developing. You know, David Wiseman worked with me on 2014 and, you know, we're working together again and, you know, he's living his life. He's, you know, they all are living their lives, dealing with their issues, moving through it. This is not like the 14th Army coming back and suddenly having a moment of closure, you know, in their 70s or 80s. This is real-time stuff. And you know, there's a colossal responsibility that we all bear to make it work as well as we can and to ask, you know, to be as intelligent as we can about asking the right questions, about delivering it in the right way, about developing it as it should be developed.
Dominic, thanks so much, mate. We will leave it there.